am the Greek goddess Harmonia. By the miracle of your technology, I can speak to you from behind the veil. Come sit with me for a few minutes for another episode of The Golden Thread. Welcome back, my friend. Last time we sat together, I told you about William Wilberforce, a man who loved God and hated injustice and spent a lifetime using every tool the system gave him to dismantle something the system had built. A patient man, a political man, a man who worked inside the walls until the walls finally moved. Today, I want to take you somewhere older, somewhere the walls did not move and the man walked through them anyway. We are going to Baghdad. We are going to the banks of the Tigris River. And we are going to meet a man whose name, even now, carries something I can only describe as heat. His name was Al-Hallaj, and I was there. I am always there. I want to take you to the riverbank before I tell you the story. It is sometime around 1910. The Tigris is wide and slow here, the color of old bronze in the afternoon light. Baghdad is a city that has seen everything. Caliphs and conquerors, plagues and poets, the rise and fall of more certainties than I care to count. I have watched all of it. I watch still. There is a small cenotaph on the bank, nothing grand, a modest marker worn smooth by nearly 1,000 years of hands, and on this particular afternoon, as on most afternoons, there are people here. A woman in a dark wrap, standing very still with her eyes closed. Two men who have traveled some distance. I can tell by their feet. A young boy who doesn't quite understand why they've stopped here, but who is quiet anyway because something in the air asks for quiet. They are not here because someone told them to come. There is no feast day, no official occasion. They have simply come, as people have been coming to this spot since the year 922 because something happened here that did not finish happening. I watch the woman's lips move. I do not hear what she says. That is between her and whatever she believes is listening. I have been watching people come to this place for centuries, scholars and sailors, grieving mothers and curious students. People who could recite Al-Hallaj's poetry by heart, and people who only knew his name and the broad shape of what was done to him here. They come from across the Islamic world and beyond it. They come in doubt and they come in fire. They touch the stone and they stand quietly, and then they go back to their lives. But something in their faces when they turn to leave is different from when they arrived. I used to wonder what they were looking for. I think I know now. They were looking for proof. Not proof of a doctrine or a theology. Proof of something simpler and harder to name. Proof that a human soul can love something so completely, so past the point of reason and safety and self-preservation, that even death cannot make it look foolish. They were looking for a window. I knew, standing there in 1910, that the flood was coming. Not a metaphor. A real flood. A swelling of the Tigris that would take this little cenotaph and scatter its stones the way the executioners had once scattered his ashes. The marker would be gone by the 1920s. This place, this particular place, would cease to be. I want to tell you what those pilgrims found here. I want to tell you who he was and what he said and what it cost him and why. 1,000 years later, ordinary people were still making their way down to this riverbank to stand quietly and touch the stone. It begins in Persia. It begins with a boy and a book and a fire that never went out. His father was a cotton carter. That is what Hallaj means. The man who takes raw cotton and pulls it apart, fiber by fiber, until it is clean and ready to become something. It is patient work. Repetitive work. Work that requires you to know the difference between what tangles and what flows. I have always thought that was worth noticing. He was born around 858 CE in a small Arabized town in the Fars province of Persia, what is now Iran. His grandfather, if you can believe it, was a Zoroastrian magus, firekeeper. The family had layers. His father moved them to a town in Wasit, in what is now Iraq, famous for its school of Quran reciters. And the boy, whose full name was Abul Mughith al-Husayn ibn Mansur al-Hallaj, though history remembers him simply as Al-Hallaj, that boy memorized the entire Quran before he was 12 years old. I want you to sit with that for a moment, not as a religious fact, as a human one. A child who has taken the most sacred text of his tradition so completely into himself that it lives in him, not on a page, not in a building, but in him, before he is old enough to have any real idea what that will cost. He was drawn from the beginning toward the interior life. In his teens, he attached himself to a Sufi teacher named Sahal al-Tustari, retreating from ordinary pursuits to study and pray. When he was 20, he moved to Basra, married. A lifelong and devoted marriage, which itself became a point of controversy among certain Sufis who felt that marriage and mysticism did not belong together. He received his Sufi habit, the distinctive garment that marked him as a recognized member of that spiritual tradition. Then he went to Baghdad to consult the great Sufi teacher Junaid, one of the most respected mystics of the age, and found himself restless. He set out on pilgrimage to Mecca, his first. In Mecca, he made a vow that I have never forgotten. He would remain in the courtyard of the sanctuary for one full year, fasting in total silence, a year in the courtyard, not a week of retreat, not a season, a year of silence in the most sacred place in the Islamic world, asking nothing and saying nothing, simply present to whatever was present. When he came back from that first pilgrimage, something had shifted. He took off the Sufi habit, the credential, the visible membership, the garment that told the world what category of person he was, and put on ordinary clothes. He said he wanted to preach more freely. And he did. He went to ordinary people in the markets and the streets and the open squares, and he talked to them about God, about love, about the interior fire. And they came in enormous numbers because something in his voice or his eyes or the way he stood told them that whatever he was talking about, he was not guessing. He made a second pilgrimage to Mecca with 400 disciples. Then he traveled east into Iran, then further to India, to Turkestan, beyond the frontiers of the Islamic world entirely. He was gone for years, preaching, moving, always moving. When he finally returned to Baghdad and settled his family there, he began to say things in public that the city was not prepared for. He stood in the streets and said, "O Muslims, save me from God." He said, "God has made my blood lawful to you. Kill me." He said, "An al-Haq, I am the truth." In Arabic, al-Haq, the truth, is one of the 99 names of God. The city heard him. The scholars heard him. The court heard him. And the long machinery of consequence began to turn. I was in Baghdad when he said it. I have heard a great many things said in a great many languages across a great many centuries, and I want to tell you something about An al-Haq that the court records do not capture. It was not said the way a man proclaims a victory. It was not loud. It was not a performance. What I heard was the sound of a man who had been pressed so far into something that the boundary between himself and that something had simply dissolved, and he was reporting it. The way you might report that the sun had risen, not as argument, as observation. The Sufi tradition had a word for this, fana, annihilation. The idea that the self, when it loves God completely enough, when it has burned away everything that is merely personal and habitual and defended, ceases to be a separate thing. Not that the person disappears, but that the wall between the person and the divine becomes so thin it is no longer a wall. What speaks then is not the ego. What speaks is whatever was always on the other side. In a closed circle of Sufi practitioners, this was understood. Difficult, demanding, dangerous to pursue, but understood. The masters knew what it pointed at. They had their own language for it, their own careful containers. Al-Halaj said it in the street. That was the thing. Not the words. The audience. He had taken off the Sufi habit years before. He had deliberately stepped outside the recognized category, the credentialed class, the world of practitioners who understood the vocabulary. He was talking to merchants and laborers and pilgrims and the merely curious, and he was saying, "I am the truth," and they were hearing something that lit them up from the inside, because it suggested, it more than suggested, that the divine was not housed exclusively in institutions and accessed only through proper channels. That it could come so close to a human soul that the two became, for a moment, indistinguishable. The Sufi masters were not pleased. Most of them kept their distance. Even Junaid, his old teacher, refused to defend him. What Al-Halaj was doing was, from one angle, deeply irresponsible, handing the language of annihilation to people who had no framework for it, no preparation, no community to catch them if the fire got too large. I understood their concern. I did not entirely disagree with it. But I also watched the faces of the people who heard him, and I knew that whatever he was carrying, it was real. The court moved against him slowly, There were supporters in high places. The process took years. He was denounced, defended, denounced again. A Shafi'i jurist refused to condemn him, saying that spiritual inspiration was beyond legal jurisdiction. Others were less generous. He was implicated, perhaps unfairly, in the political turbulence of the Abbasid court, rival factions using his name and his movement as weapons in their own struggles. That is how it usually goes. The mystic becomes a pawn, the fire becomes a pretext. They arrested him in 9/11. He spent 9 years in prison. 9 years. And during that time, the conditions of his confinement shifted with the tides of court politics, sometimes harsh, sometimes almost tolerable, depending on who held influence that week. He was not broken. The people who visited him, who managed to get access to him in those years, reported that he seemed, and I say this carefully because I saw it myself, at peace. Not resigned, not defeated, at peace. The final condemnation came in 922. The charge technically was political. They accused him of wanting to destroy the Kaaba, twisting his words about the Kaaba of the heart into something treasonous. The Queen Mother interceded. The Caliph briefly revoked the order. The vizier's intrigues reversed it again. On the 25th of March, trumpets announced his execution the following day. I will not dwell on what happened on the banks of the Tigris. I will tell you that thousands of people came to watch, and that his last recorded words were about the unique reducing him to unity, which, if you have been listening, you will understand was not a statement of defeat. His body was burned, his ashes were scattered into the river, and the next morning someone began to build a cenotaph on the bank. I have watched a great many fires go out. Empires, movements, ideas that seemed, in their moment, so bright and necessary that I could not imagine the world continuing without them. And then they dimmed, and then they were gone, and the world continued anyway, indifferent and vast, and eventually even I stopped looking for the light that had been there. Al-Hallaj did not go out. That is the thing I want you to understand. The court did everything courts do when they want to erase a person. Public execution, burned body, scattered ashes, no tomb, no marker, no object around which devotion could coalesce. They had seen it done before. They knew the method. What they did not account for was the poets. Within a generation, Attar of Nishapur was writing about him. Attar, who gave the world the Conference of the Birds, that great Sufi poem about the soul's journey toward the divine, placed Al-Hallaj at the center of his telling of what it means to love God past the point of self-preservation. A century after that, Rumi, who is perhaps the most widely read poet in human history, returned to Al-Hallaj again and again as the image of the soul consumed by divine love. Hafiz, Al-Ghazali, Sanai, the names go on and they are not minor names. They are the names that carried the Persian mystical tradition across centuries and continents and into languages and cultures that the Abbasid court could not have imagined. What travels in a witnessed life that cannot travel in an argument? I have thought about this for a long time, longer than most. An argument addresses the mind. It gives the mind something to work with. Premises, conclusions, evidence, counter-evidence. The mind is good at this. The mind can hold an argument, examine it, accept it, reject it, file it away. Arguments are useful. I do not dismiss them. But a witnessed life does something different. It addresses something beneath the mind, something that recognizes before it understands. When Rumi writes about Al-Hallaj, it is not because Al-Hallaj's theology was airtight. It is because Al-Hallaj demonstrated something at the highest possible cost in the most public possible way that Rumi recognized as true before he could explain why. The demonstration bypassed the argument entirely and arrived somewhere deeper. This is what the poets received, not a doctrine, a proof of concept. And here is what I find remarkable, standing far enough back to see the whole shape of it. Al-Hallaj himself was not trying to found a movement. He was not building an institution. He laid down the Sufi habit precisely because he did not want the costume, the credential, the category. He went to ordinary people in ordinary clothes because he wanted the thing itself to travel, not the container it usually came in. And it did. Stripped of its container, it traveled further and lasted longer than almost anything the container builders of his era produced. The cenotaph drew pilgrims for nearly 1,000 years. But the cenotaph was never really the point. The point was what those pilgrims carried home, a quiet confirmation, a steadying, the knowledge not argued into them but recognized that the interior fire is real, that a human soul can be organized around something greater than its own survival. That love of the divine is not a poetic metaphor or a comfortable sentiment, but a force that can walk a man to the banks of a river and hold him there unbroken while the world does its worst. That knowledge passed from Al-Halaj to Attar to Rumi to Hafiz and through them into the bloodstream of human spiritual imagination, into the Persian tradition, into the broader Islamic mystical world, into the consciousness of people who had never heard of Baghdad or the Abbasid court or the political intrigues of 922 CE. It passed, as these things always pass, not through institutions but through recognition. One soul reading another soul across the centuries and saying, yes, that is what I already half believed but had not yet seen proven at that cost. That is what the poets found in him. That is what the pilgrims found at the cenotaph. And I want to tell you what happened to the cenotaph and why it matters that it is gone. I went back to the riverbank in the 1920s. The world I found there was not the world I had left. The Ottoman Empire, 6 centuries of it, was gone. The maps of the Middle East were being redrawn by men in European offices who had never stood on this soil, never heard the call to prayer echo off these walls, never watched the Tigris go bronze in the afternoon light. The old order had not merely changed, it had been swept away with a thoroughness that left people standing in the rubble of certainties they had assumed were permanent. And the Tigris was rising. I watched the water come, slow at first, the way these things always are, a gradual encroachment, a widening of the margin, a softening of the bank, and then less slow. And then the cenotaph, that worn and modest stone that had stood on this bank since the morning after his execution, was taken by the river and carried away. I will tell you honestly, I felt something when it went. Not grief exactly, something quieter than grief. The recognition that a chapter had closed, that whatever this place had been holding, it would have to be held somewhere else now. But here is what I kept thinking, standing there watching the water. 1,000 years of pilgrims had already come. Whatever they needed from this place, they had already received it. The stone was not the source. It never had been. It was only ever a marker, a way of saying here. Something happened here that did not finish happening. The transmission was already complete. I think about those pilgrims now when I look at the world we are living in, because I see something in it that I recognize. The old containers are going or gone. Not just in the Middle East, not just in the aftermath of one war or one empire's collapse, but everywhere and in the deepest places. The institutions that held the sacred for so many generations are losing their hold. People are leaving, not because they stopped caring about the fire, in many cases because they care about it too much to stay somewhere it has gone cold. And I understand the leaving. I do not dismiss it, but I watch what people do when they leave, and I worry about something. I see people assembling private religions from the parts of traditions they find appealing. A little of this, a little of that, nothing that costs anything, nothing that asks anything that the self is not already inclined to give. A spirituality as comfortable as furniture. And I want to say gently, as a friend, that is not what Al-Halaj found on the banks of the Tigris. That is not what 1,000 years of pilgrims came to find. What they came to find was proof that the fire is real. Not comfortable, not assembled from pleasing parts. Real in the way that Gandhi was real, walking to the sea to make salt when the empire said he could not, in the way that Martin Luther King was real, standing in Birmingham knowing exactly what standing there would cost, in the way that Mandela was real, choosing forgiveness when bitterness would have been so much easier and so much more understandable. We do not follow these people because their theology is airtight. We follow them. We return to them, we quote them, we name our children after them, because they demonstrated something, because they showed us, at cost we can barely imagine, that a human soul can be organized around something greater than its own comfort and survival. And seeing that, really seeing it, letting it land, does something to us that no argument can do. It gives us a window, not a map, Not a destination, a window, a glimpse of what is possible in a human life when the interior fire is taken seriously enough to follow all the way. Al-Halaj was that window for Rumi, for Attar, for the woman I watched standing at the cenotaph in 1910, her lips moving, her eyes closed. He is still that window if you let him be. Not because his answers are your answers, but because his willingness, his absolute costly, unretractable willingness to follow the longing wherever it led, speaks to something in you that already knows the fire is real. You already know. That is what I believe after all this time watching. The longing is not the problem. The longing is the most honest thing about you. The question is only whether you will take it seriously enough, whether you will let it ask something of you, whether you will follow it past the comfortable edges of what costs nothing. The cenotaph is gone. The river took it. But the fire that drew people to that riverbank for 1,000 years, that did not go into the water. That is still burning, and I think you can feel it even now. I want to ask you something, and I want you to actually sit with it, not answer it quickly and move on. Who showed you the fire was real? Not who argued you into believing something. Not who gave you the right words at the right moment, though that matters too. I mean, who demonstrated it? Who lived in a way that landed in you like recognition? Who made you feel, not think, but feel? Yes, that. That is what I already half believed, but had not seen proven at that cost. Maybe it was someone famous. Maybe it was someone who will never have a cenotaph, never have a poet write about them, never be remembered outside the small circle of people whose lives they quietly reorganized. A teacher, a grandparent, someone who held to something when holding to it was hard, and you watched them hold it, and something in you shifted. I have seen this happen in the grandest theaters of history and in the quietest rooms imaginable. The mechanism is the same. One human soul demonstrating that the fire is real, and another human soul recognizing it and being changed by the recognition. You were changed. I suspect you know exactly who I mean. And here is the part I want you to carry with you today, the part that feels important to say before we part. Someone is watching you. Maybe you know who, maybe you don't. But somewhere in the circle of your life there is a person, perhaps a young person, perhaps someone who has not told you what they are carrying, for whom your own held commitment might be the proof they needed. Not your arguments, not your explanations, the simple fact of how you live, what you hold to when holding is difficult, what you return to when you have every reason to walk away. You may never know you are someone's window. Al-Halaj did not build the cenotaph. He did not plan the poets. He did not arrange for 1,000 years of pilgrims to find their way to the bank of the Tigris. He simply followed the fire, all the way without reservation, past every point where a reasonable person might have stopped. And the rest happened because of that, just that. Next time I want to take you to ancient India, to a prince, a young man born into every comfort the world could offer, wealth, status, a family who loved him, a future already arranged and waiting. And one day he looked at all of it, and he walked away. Not in despair, not in anger. In pursuit of something he could not name but could not ignore. His name was Mahavira. And the path he walked, barefoot, in silence, through heat and cold and every hardship the world could arrange, became the foundation of one of the oldest living spiritual traditions on earth. A tradition built entirely on the conviction that every living thing carries within it something sacred. Every living thing. I was there when he walked out of the palace. I remember the morning light. Come back and I will tell you what I saw. But for now, stay with Al-Halaj a little longer if you need to. Stay with the question I left you with. Stay with whoever came to mind when I asked who showed you the fire was real. That is not a question to answer quickly and file away. That is a question to live with for a while and let it ask something of you. The tapestry is long. The threads are countless, and every now and then, if you look closely enough, you can see where one thread catches the light. Where a single life lived with that kind of completeness sends brightness running through everything it touches, forward and backward through time, further than anyone standing on the banks of the Tigris in 922 could possibly have imagined. Al-Halaj was one of those threads. So perhaps are you. Much love. I am Harmonia. Thank you. you for listening, dear one. If this episode meant something to you, I'd love it if you'd leave a 5-star rating. It helps more people find their way here. And if you subscribe, you will never miss a thread and share this story with someone you love. One more thing, my friend, look in your episode notes. There's a link there that leads back to our little community. Leave a comment. I promise. I read everyone. This podcast sails out to you from Red Buoy Media, LLC. The stories we share are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share Alike 4.0 International. That means you can pass them along, remix them, and even argue with them. Just give us credit, don't try to sell them, and share responsibly. Thanks for listening, friend. Until our next adventure.